Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 50, Roman's Fort. So for the last, it seems like 3 months now, we've talked about the New York campaign. Part of the discussion, we had kind of just glossed over the fact that Washington was very interested in protecting the Hudson River from the British Navy. But why? What makes this river so special? The Hudson River finds its source at Lake Tear of Clouds in the Adirondack Mountains. Numerous tributaries feed as it flows south for 315 miles through eastern New York. It's on these numerous waterways that towns, cities, ports will grow. The Hudson River is an economic artery, and it starts in these small towns, bringing product down to Manhattan. Manhattan will grow as an economic center. It's the lifeblood of the New York colony, and the British realize this. The Continental Army is using these supplies to help further their cause, to supply their army. They can move troops freely up and down the river. If the British can take that away, New York would fold up really quickly. The next key component is, of course, the fact that the revolution starts in New England. We've talked about this before. New England was the birthplace of the revolution. Yes, there are others in like places like Virginia and Pennsylvania that are backing the revolution. But the key light that sparks the flame, it happens in New England. And it is no doubt that New England sent many patriots. We just talked about over 7 regiments in 1776 from Connecticut alone. New Hampshire is going to have almost 10 regiments by the end of the war. Massachusetts, numerous militia. These troops are the lifeblood of the Continental Army. If you could take that away from Washington, if you could take that away from the Continental Army, there's a very strong possibility that colonies where the revolution at the beginning was lukewarm, could fall back on those same ideals. New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, the Carolinas. You could completely obliterate the revolution in several colonies right off the bat. So the Hudson River is key because it keeps that revolutionary fire burning and flowing from New England into the other colonies. The British realize that, and so does Washington. Washington needs to do something about it. Now, this series of episodes, I'm going to be using a book called Chaining the Hudson. And I'll tell you that straight out, that as a book recommendation, it is going to be Chaining the Hudson. This book talks about the several attempts or the several different ways that the Continental Army will try and utilize what they have available to them to stop the British Navy from moving from Manhattan north into places like Albany and even farther up towards Fort Ticonderoga, where in mid-1776, it was the home base for the Northern Army. At the beginning of the New York campaign, we discussed how the colonies were broken up into 7 different departments. The smallest of which was the Highlands Department. Only covering 150,000 acres, it consisted of a 10-mile stretch of the Hudson River. At this point, the granite rose high above the river, a position that, if properly fortified, could protect against any incursion from the south by the British Army. And around about the time that Ethan Allen made his infamous capture of Fort Ticonderoga, the Continental Congress will organize a 10-man commission to work out details and plans for the protection of this vital piece of the river. They form the Highlands Department, and this 10-man commission will handle the day-to-day activities. They'll handle plans for fortifications, hire on workers, sort out supply details. This commission was really a full-time job. In late 1775, they're looking for ideas for a fort that can go on the river. Well, this was just perfect timing for Bernard Romans, who happened to be in Philadelphia at the time. Born in the Netherlands in 1740, he is educated in England. In 1757, he is sent to Georgia as a surveyor. In the 1760s, he'll travel throughout Florida. But Romans will find himself back in Connecticut during the early political struggle of the Revolution. Like all men on the side of independence, he joins the fight after Lexington and Concord. He'll be given $100 by the Connecticut Commission of Safety to raise a militia. Romans will lead these men in capturing Fort George, which was on Lake George. He'll move all the supplies back to Fort Ticonderoga, and Romans will find himself back in the Boston area just in time for the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, it's unclear if he or any of his men joined in this battle, but in the fall of 1775, Romans is recommended to the New York Commission of Safety to build a fort on the Hudson. So somewhere in this confusing bit of timeline, he was in Boston in the summer of 75, finds himself now in the fall of 75 in the Philadelphia area, where he is recommended to the New York Commission of Safety to build a fort on the Hudson. Romans' planned location was an island called Martelator's Rock, a butchered Dutch pronunciation, which I probably butchered, so it's a butchering pronunciation of a butchering pronunciation. The actual Dutch name was Martelaar's Reek, which is actually translated into Martyr's Reach. This is given by Dutch sailors for the extremely difficult section of river in this area. The rock, as it is referred to, lay across the river about a quarter mile from the west point. On the east side of the rock was a large marsh that was nearly impossible to cross, which is why they consider the rock an island. The highest point on the island was only about 150 feet, though, making the opposite shore, where the west point was, higher than the rock itself, which means that any enemy that put guns on that side of the river could easily lob shells into the fort. So right off the bat, not the prime location. But we'll continue on. Romans planned to build so massive a complex that it would be considered impregnable. Due to the fact that the rock was low, Romans started with an octagonal blockhouse. An odd design, but he swore that it would protect the powder and stores from any attack from above, meaning cannonballs that were fired from the opposite shore and lobbed into the fort, or a passing ship that was firing shells from the quarterdeck. That blockhouse would be inside a five-sided fort with bastions that would support five batteries totaling 81 guns. With the fort came a 200-foot-long curtain rampart. This would have several subterranean bomb-proofs and magazines. For all of this, he was going to charge the New York colony the low price of $5,000. And he estimated that it would take 4 months to construct. Now, this estimation right off the bat should have raised some eyebrows. The type of fort he was planning, with the political climate that we have in 1775, was going to be impossible. The amount of supplies and workforce that would be needed to take on such a venture were astronomical for the time in the colonial America. But on September 13th, the commissioners met with Romans and on the rock itself reviewed the plans for the fort. The problems with the placement of the fort were noticeable from the beginning. The first thing is, line of sight along the river was not great. Second was the fact that the rock was lower than the opposite shore on West Point. With all these logistical problems, it's no wonder that Romans and the commissioners were at odds with each other from the very beginning. The argument between Romans and the commissioners reached Philadelphia. But with the war growing, defenses had to be made on the Hudson, and it was of the utmost importance that this river was protected. So in late September, work commences on the fort. It becomes painfully obvious that the construction should have started much earlier. The rock, for years, had been a source of timber for the surrounding area, so the island had little resources on it to use for construction. And now we're getting into October, and the situation for Romans and his fort were getting to be dire. Construction was way behind schedule. Romans' original timetable said that it would take 4 months, which means that the fort would have been completed by January. Now, not many people have been to upstate New York in January, but I have, And I promise you that the weather up there doesn't always cooperate. But we haven't even gotten into winter yet, and it's already behind schedule. At this point, the Siege of Boston was in progress, and the Northern Army was invading Canada. So supplies and manpower were incredibly short. Not to mention the fact that the $5,000 budget that he swore he could build this fort for was already almost gone. So as progress on the fort slowed to a snail's pace, it was becoming clear to Romans that it may never be finished. Which is exactly what happened in November of 1775. The Continental Congress and the New York Commission of Safety saw Roman's fort as a massive failure and shut it down. Though Roman's fort was a complete failure, Congress knows that they have to defend the Hudson in any way possible. So they decided to make river defenses a military matter, rather than trying to find a civilian contractor to take the job. And that's where we're going to leave our story this week. So over the next few episodes, we're going to talk about these river defenses. I've fallen into the same trap as I always do, where I try and paint with words a picture, and it's really hard to paint a blueprint of Roman's fort. I will try and put up on the Facebook page a picture of Roman's fort. It is a very interesting looking fortification, to say the least, and had Romans had the manpower and resources to do it, who knows what could have happened. I don't know that would have been terribly successful, but I still think that it was interesting, to say the least. Who knows if they were able to build that and then build West Point, the two forts together, probably could have made traveling on the Hudson River for the British Army next to impossible. But that is what if history, and I do love what if history, but it doesn't write books. And so every good historian likes to contemplate what if history, but it never gives you the answer that you're looking for. That's going to do it for this episode. The next couple of weeks, we're going to spend some time really breaking apart these river defenses and kind of talking about how they were used, what they were used for, and what kind of relevance they have on the American Revolution and even into the future. The next episode is an episode I'm really excited about, where we get to see one of the few wonder weapons in history that really had an impact on the future of warfare. So that will be interesting. These episodes, I just want everyone to understand, we're going to bounce around a lot. We're going to kind of move through the timeline at our own leisure as we just talk about these several different topics and instances where these types of river defenses were used. I'm trying to make sure that I keep them separate from our story arc, because when I come back, we are now going to move into the Northern Department, and we're going to kind of just hit a rewind button. We took ourselves all the way to December of 1776. We are now going to rewind back to March of 1776 and talk about what's going on with the Northern Army. But for the next couple of weeks or the next month or so, we're going to talk about river defenses, and it's going to kind of be – they're going to kind of be a standalone on their own, which is what I'm aiming for. So as I end this week, I just want to leave you off with a book recommendation, and I said it at the beginning of the episode, but it's Chaining the Hudson. Written by Lincoln Dymont, this book is what is going to be my guide for these episodes. It's a really good book. If you're really interested in history along the Hudson River, this is the book for you. If you're interested in American Revolution naval history, this is the book for you. I cannot recommend this book enough. And it's one of the I really think it's a standalone book. There aren't any other books that cover this kind of topic that have been written about. So it's a definite one that should be added to every American Revolution historian's library collection. So we're going to end this week. I kind of got onto a little ramble sesh at the end of that episode. I'm really sorry. So next week we are going to talk about the turtle. I'm not going to say what the turtle is. I'm not going to spoil it because it is probably one of the more interesting topics that we are going to talk about. But till next week, everyone have a great week. And as always, keep the powder dry.